everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Substation podcast. My name is Emma Burns.
And my name is Tom Edwards.
And this is our second episode in the Security of Supply series. Last week, we looked at Security of Supply 101. So we talked about some of the key concepts around security supply of energy. And today we're going to focus in on the market mechanisms that we have in place across the world to ensure that there is sufficient energy and capacity built to meet customers' needs. So, Tom, where do you want to start?
Well, let's dive in with a concept. In GB, we have deregulated or liberalized energy markets. But Tom, I hear you say, what is a liberalized or deregulated energy market?
I've never heard of such a thing.
Most of the people listening, or at least judging by the dashboard we get, probably live in an area with a deregulated or liberalized electricity market. And that basically means that the state or a single body isn't in charge of the whole market. So there's not like an end-to-end state-owned delivery of energy to your house, and that different parties operate different parts of the system. Some bits may be monopolies, but where possible, competition exists either in the generation or supply of energy. So in that kind of market, the idea is that a private company or person, if they were rich enough, I suppose, could operate a power station, and they could expect to earn enough money through the selling of that commodity or other services related to energy, and they would earn enough to either build or operate that piece of equipment.
Mm. I suppose with the broad thinking being that competition and markets, liberalized markets, should lead to better outcomes for consumers than having things state-owned and centrally determined.
That is the theory.
That's the theory, yeah.
Yeah, and the simplest of these designs in terms of security of supply is what you would term an energy-only market. So this is where you get only the revenue that you earn comes from you selling the raw commodity, the energy. There aren't many of these in electricity, especially in Europe. There's more of them around the world. So, for example, some American markets are energy only. I think the NEM is energy only as well.
In Australia, the National Electricity
yes.
Market?
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea there is, yeah, you just get the value for the energy that you provide. So if I generate electricity or provide gas, I get paid for that commodity. I don't get any sort of extra payments for other stuff.
Can I interject there with a slightly pedantic point, which is... Mm. I would argue that GB technically is still an energy-only market, so it was created as such in 2001. We did admittedly add on an additional mechanism later on in 2014. However, that is technically transitional and a short-term mechanism. And European legislation and regulations and their view of market design was so inspired by the British experience that a lot of that legislation is driving towards, the principle is that we should be still driving towards these energy-only markets. And the principle is that capacity markets should only be a transitional mechanism.
Yeah, and that's the guidance at the European level. So the internal energy market in Europe is an energy-only design, and you should only have an intervention where there is a market failure. And we'll get on to some of those interventions in a bit. So one of the other things about an energy-only market is, I guess you could say a benefit is that you kind of get a better all-in price. So the energy should be reflective, or theoretically, you should be getting a more efficient price, more efficient behaviour. One of the downsides might be is that we tend to see, or at least in GB, the experience is that you tend to see vertical integration. So in response to these kind of self-dispatch, which means you're in charge of what happens, energy-only markets is you get to one of the... people want the natural hedge, so they want to own both the supply, the upstream, and the demand, the downstream bit. And by doing that, you know, if prices crash, you're still making money in your demand side, even if your generation is losing out. And then if prices rise, even if you're losing money in your demand side, you're making money on your generation side. And so you're kind of hedged against that risk. And we saw in GB that was one of the strategies, along with gaining economies of scale. So trying to be as big as possible is the other.
There's two different concepts there, though, isn't it? Because energy-only market is one thing where you don't have separate capacity payments, and self-dispatch market is another thing.
Mm.
And in GB, we introduce both at the same time. So you can have a self-dispatch or a central dispatch market, but they could also both then either be energy only or capacity payments. And with the sort of central dispatch, meaning there is a central body, a black box, an algorithm.
Somebody else decides what you're
Someone else tells you what to do. And yes, self-dispatch is I tell you what I'm going to do. Yeah.
And those particular two things together led to that particular situation, which is, I guess, the experience I've got. So I'm saying that is one of the things. So one thing about energy-only designs is that if capacity expansion decisions are only driven by energy prices, that we tend to see boom and bust cycles, which may not necessarily be in customers' interests. So the way that you might decide to build a new power station or retire your power station or make a decision about your equipment is that prices will need to rise because of scarcity. So if you see in the future something is retiring, the price will go up because the people left in the market have market power. They can capture in for marginal rent. So the prices rise. Someone sees that happening in the long-term markets, decide to build something. What you tend to find then is that there might then be a glut of overcapacity. So if lots of people see the same signal, we might overbuild and then we'll see a glut. The price will then fall as it goes closer to the marginal cost of these new, more efficient bits of kit that have been put on the system. That should then force generators off the system. The older, less efficient ones should then be forced out. The prices should fall. Those guys fall. The price will then go back up again because of the scarcity. And we're in this boom and bust cycle, which should ideally kind of flatten itself out, but in reality leads to quite negative consequences. Mm-hmm. So you tend to see, you know, when prices rise, as they do now, customers don't like it. When prices fall, generators tend to go bust, and then you start getting scary headlines about capacity crunches and stuff like that. So governments don't like that very much.
Just to explain some of the concepts there. So we talked about scarcity pricing, which is sort of extreme high pricing. We talked about marginal pricing, which is sort of the bare minimum, I suppose, for each marginal unit that...
The break-even cost.
And then the kind of bit almost in between, or that can sit somewhere between those two, is this idea of inframarginal rent, which is something over and above that marginal break-even point that's basically profit that we... Yeah, in energy.
Yeah. So because of this, generally price stabilization mechanisms get introduced into energy markets. And capacity mechanisms are generally measures taken to support the medium to long-term electricity security of supply, or energy security of supply. I guess one of the things to mention here is that gas, we don't have capacity mechanisms of the equivalent in gas. You tend to see, because gas is more liquid, pardon the pun, and by what I mean is, because gas is widely traded and there are good price discovery and lots of people trading the commodity, that you can sign long-term agreements. And of course, you've got countries like Qatar, Russia, Iran, etc., who all like to sign long-term agreements with people. So these should be like multi-decade agreements for buying gas, so that, you know, I have a contract to buy a boat and it will arrive once every month and it'll have this much gas in it, and I've paid lots of money, or I have agreed to pay a reference price, for example. So that's one of the benefits of being in a liquid market for gas, is that you don't need that kind of capacity remuneration scheme.
Another kind of interesting, or a potential con, I suppose, for energy only markets is this, and related to this idea of scarcity rent, is the kind of fine line between scarcity rent in the true sense and market power. So there's, I think you mentioned, there's kind of this political discomfort with prices rising to a certain level, but there's also almost a regulatory discomfort as well, whereby you don't necessarily know if prices rise to a certain level, that is driven by true market fundamentals, or if a party in the market is behaving in a manipulative, you know, market manipulative kind of way.
Yeah. So that was one of the issues with the pool, which did have a capacity payment in it, was that they were accused of being able to manipulate the price. So if we wanted to introduce some form of price stabilization scheme, perhaps a capacity mechanism, generally there are four main approaches. So the first one is what we would call a strategic reserve. So in a strategic reserve, we keep some form of capacity or equipment outside of the market, and they're paid something to remain available, but only for security of supply. So generally only the system operator or some other centrally responsible body would be the only ones who are capable of dispatching that equipment in order to provide energy to the system. One of the benefits of this kind of scheme is that it would be smaller than the other types of schemes. So you're only paying a smaller amount of people or pieces of equipment. They usually want quite a high price because they're foregoing revenues in all the other parts of the market to be available for this. But because you're only needing to buy like one, two, or three, four, or five, you know, generators as opposed to the whole pay the whole market a price, it's lower cost than those other schemes. However, the downside is that they can be accused of distorting markets. So if you're keeping a bunch of spare capacity outside of the market, then you can lead to, you know, you can thin down the liquidity, which can make prices less reflective of the realistic conditions. And you can also stop scarcity prices because consumers know that the scarcity is never going to come because the system operator always has a spare bit down the back of the sofa.
Yeah. And there's also this idea, which is sort of related to this, but maybe a bit different, with this idea of the slippery slope. So that was always in the development of the British capacity market. I remember that was always one of the arguments against this kind of strategic reserve mechanism, whereby if you create something that takes generators out of the market and gives them a nice steady payment just to sit there, then maybe that creates incentives for generators to withdraw from the market in order to get that payment. So it's sort of a slippery slope effect there.
Yeah. So an example here would be the Supplemental Balancing Reserve in 2016, which was implemented in Great Britain, which colloquially was called the retirement home for old power stations.
I never heard that. That's good.
Yeah. Because older power stations would just go, oh, well, there's some money here. Let's see out the end of our life here. Another example would be in Germany. So that in Germany, they've got three types of strategic reserve. There's the capacity reserve, which is like a strategic reserve. There's then the climate reserve. And the difference between the two is that only the lignite cannot participate in the capacity reserve, and it can only be in the climate reserve. And then the climate reserve will only be dispatched after all the capacity reserve is gone. So the lignite will never be used as the kind of first port of call. They'll always try and turn something else on first. And then there's the grid reserve, which is about dealing with constraints or bottlenecks on the system. I think they're thinking about moving away from this. And then you also had Belgium. They had 1-year agreements to deal with short-term capacity deficits, and they've now moved to an auction for market-wide capacity.
And as we mentioned, European legislation would say that they have to move away from these capacity markets eventually.
Yeah, so the guidance from the Commission, if I recall correctly, is basically, yeah, you should only have these if you can identify a market defect, and then you've got to pick the least distortive one out of the available options that they give you, which I think are strategic reserves, and the next one we'll talk about, which is centralized capacity markets. And then you've also got to plot a way out. The first thing you've got to do, you've got to make sure your market is fully reflective and transparent. That's the first step. If it is, and you've still got a defect, then you're allowed to explore these other options.
Yeah, and this option, so the strategic reserve option, is different to the other ones you're going to talk about now, because it's a targeted mechanism rather than a market-wide mechanism. That's a key difference.
So the next one is the centralized capacity market. So this is a capacity mechanism where eligible capacity is given a payment to maintain minimum levels of security, and those levels of security are determined by a central body, and it's the central body who goes out and buys that and then pays for that capacity to be available. So when I say eligible capacity, that can vary. You can have existing capacity, you can have new capacity, they can be together, they can be apart. You can have different fuel types taking part, so you could exclude certain fuels, for example. So there's an emissions limit in the GB one, which kicks out coal, basically. And you can reward different technologies to different extents as well. So you can have derating factors that will modify the capacity that different types of technologies receive, favouring one form over another. And once you set this up, you then need to kind of monitor it, activate it, make sure it works. So often there's some kind of penalty. So for example, in GB, there's a penalty price for failing to deliver over a fairly arbitrary security of supply event. In Ireland, there's an even better kind of version where you have a strike price. So I think it's 500 euros a megawatt hour, where if the price goes over 500 euro a megawatt hour, you have to pay the difference back to the electricity consumer, so that there's a kind of, you've got to basically run, as long as the price is under 500 megawatt hours, you always run. And the price clears a lot higher in the Irish market, so it's definitely worth taking part in. Generally competitively allocated as well, so some form of auction would usually be used. Say, for example, PJM was the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, the largest electricity market in the world. It was the pioneer in that. GB has got competitive allocation. Ireland has got competitive allocation. I think Poland, which bases its system off the GB one, also has auctions. So that's a centralised one. And we'll probably maybe have a bonus episode where we moan a bit about the GB one, but we don't want to go into too much detail. So there's another option, which is a decentralized capacity market. So this is, rather than contracting directly with a central body, there's some form of requirement or market created so that suppliers or other counterparties have to present either options, obligations, or some form of certificate that shows that they have procured a minimum level of either reliability or capacity. So for example, you might call these a reliability option, and a supplier has to have enough present enough reliability options to show that they covered all of their peak demand between 4 to 7 p.m. November to February. They've then got to go to the generators, procure those certificates, which have been issued by another body, and then the supplier has to present them again at the end of the year to show that they did. That's an example. May or may not work like that. There's different schemes. So France has a scheme that's like this. Suppliers have to provide a certain amount of options to show that they've bought the right amount of capacity. Price clears very low in France because the system is very well supplied. But another example would be that the Energy Systems Catapult was recommending this kind of reliability option scheme in their Rethinking Electricity Markets paper, where they were basically thinking, well, actually, let's let consumers pay what they want for capacity adequacy. If they don't want as much, they don't have to buy as much. And then you could have people making different decisions about where and how they want to get their reliability.
Question, does a reliability option, does that necessarily mean it's decentralized? And could you have a centralized reliability option mechanism? Because from memory, and I might be wrong here, when we were thinking about what kind of capacity market to introduce in GB, there was definitely thought given to something called reliability option, which I understood was, there was still quite a heavy central element to it, and it was, but the key difference to what we have now is that it was more financial based. So it was more like there is a specific strike price, and the price may go over and above that, and if so, you pay back. So actually kind of similar to what we have in Ireland. But I think you can, yeah, again, this could be just getting into the weeds and there's a lot of nuances here, but I think you could have a centralized reliability option as well as a decentralized reliability option.
I think I wouldn't call it an option if it's that centralized. I think you have to have the option, like the consumer, the person's buying it has to have the option of choosing not to buy it.
Yeah, true.
That would be where I would draw the line on decentralized, centralized.
Interesting.
And which is kind of where I was coming from in that, and where I've read it being done, which is why I would put that, you know, the Irish one in the centralized pot, rather than, even though, you know, there's the strike price element, I see that more of a as a price control mechanism than a option.
Yeah, so I think Ireland do actually define, or they call it a reliability option. So I think,
do they call it the remuneration mechanism? I thought
the old one, I think, well, they call it a capacity market remuneration mechanism, and is in the form of reliability options, which reward providers who contribute to reliability where needed.
But you don't have an option of purchase. As a consumer, I have to purchase it from the central body. I don't get a choice about, which is, I guess, that's where you'd make the distinction between centralized and decentralized.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wouldn't call it an option if I don't have the option of choosing not to buy it.
Yeah, it's government are taking the option, but you're not giving customers individually that option themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The final one, I'm going to call flat capacity payments. So this is where the value of capacity is determined centrally. So system operator, government, whoever says, okay, we think capacity is worth £25 a kilowatt, everyone connected to the system will automatically receive this amount of money just for being there. So this is generally frowned upon in most market design circles because it's quite blunt. And however, it was actually used in many market designs. So for example, in the GB pool before 2001, there was a capacity payment to everyone. I think it was in a pound per kilowatt per settlement period. So for every settlement period you were available, you received some money.
Same in Ireland before they moved to the new market. There was a centrally determined pot of money, which was for capacity payments, and that was effectively divvied up.
Yeah. And everyone who was connected got a share of it, didn't they? Yeah. Spain had one until 2018. They were forced by the European Commission to get rid of it. But you can have these be more targeted. So, for example, Spain also had a scheme which was only open to new investments. So any new investments that connected to the system would get this pot of money for a certain amount of time. And they called that an investment subsidy. That apparently in 2020, about 70% of their investment subsidies actually rolled over and ended. So they had a bit of a, if you were a generator in Spain, there was a bit of a cliffhanging edge in 2020 when that kind of subsidy ran out. Yeah, so those are the kind of four general schools of thought for price stabilization mechanisms. But security of supply is not just having enough stuff on the system, it's also about how you operate it.
And I guess, well, I suppose from a investor's perspective, it's not just about security of supply payments, isn't it not? It's about how much money in total am I going to get paid, and is that enough to make my investment worthwhile? So that would be
energy. Yeah, because you've got to add up the energy, the capacity, and electricity is not just megawatts through your meter. You also have to cope with voltage. There's frequency deviations. There's short circuit issues, oscillations, and all sorts of other stuff like constraints that all need to be managed to make sure that the electrons flow around the circuit. And these are basically all the other stuff that's needed to keep the lights on, often referred to as ancillary services or balancing services. So what are the issues that the kind of system operators might be dealing with? So in electricity, they'll be dealing with response and reserve for frequency management. So this is keeping the instantaneous balance of supply and demand within the right range, around in Europe 50 hertz. And that means keeping generators either on standby or warmed up, or operating with some headroom to respond very quickly to changes in the system. In gas, they're dealing with margin, so keeping the line pack, the amount of gas in the pipes, at the right level so that the pressure is in kind of right area. It gets more complicated in electricity again, because then we can start talking about inertia and short circuit levels, which are the kind of stability of the system or its resistance to change. Different types of generators provide different...
There's a series in those. That's a whole series, isn't it? Yeah.
There's a whole series we can talk about in inertia and short circuit. I'm not going to talk about that now. Then you might be talking about voltage. So you need to keep the voltage on the system within the prescribed levels to make sure that the power flows as efficiently as possible, which can be done by running generators in different ways. You've got constraints. So if they've overinvested or underinvested in certain areas, there's different types of things. You might be approaching the thermal limit of the line or the fault level on the line. So if something goes wrong, you might trip a circuit somewhere. So you need to kind of constrain output in one area and bring it up in another to keep the system balanced. And there's all sorts of services out there to deal with all of these issues. But the important things from a kind of, I guess, in security supply point of view, or let's say from an investor point of view, is how are they procured? How do we buy them? So are we buying them in the long term? Does someone identify a need and provide enough money for someone to invest in providing that need over the long term? Or are we buying it in the short term, day to day, and buying it from the best possible source from all of the available resources across the system, kind of trying to bid in real time? So is it long term or short term? How much can you bank on it? Do we need a new resource, or can we get it from somebody who's already on the system? And the other one is, how can we stack it? How does it fit into that investment landscape? Because when, as you mentioned before, if I'm an investor, I want to know, how much am I going to get for the energy I sell? How much am I going to get for any capacity I might be rewarded for? Then the ancillary services. So it's a package, right? Because most new bits of kit that we're going to add to the system are going to be capable of doing lots of stuff. And given the focus on keeping costs down for net zero and the falling costs of new technologies, the competition is fierce. You've got to squeeze every pound out of your investment possible. Mm. So it's very important to look at all of this stuff when making an investment.
And I think that the point about the long-term, short-term procurement one is quite interesting as well, because there's kind of a bit of a fine line, I suppose, between long-term ancillary service contracts and capacity contracts, in my mind. So in, like, here we used to, in GB, we used to have long-term contracts for reserve, and the contracts for Black Start, which we talked about last week, were, are also and have been historically quite long term. And in theory, maybe depending on what that contract is, and, you know, in theory, that could almost act like a capacity market, where it's locking a generator in, giving them reliable payments and ensuring that they'll stay on the system for however many years.
To the extent that long-term store agreements, when they were originally made, are excluded from taking part in the capacity agreement.
Yeah.
So store is a form of reserve on the system, the short-term operational reserve.
Yeah.
They are excluded from taking part in the capacity market because it was felt that they're based, that would basically be double rewarding them. They got paid under the store to for long-term agreements in fixed payments. And I think that's the key thing, is that if an ancillary, if it's long-term or short-term, long should really only be used where you can identify a clear need that I'm going to need it for a long time and nobody's there already providing it.
And I think, I think maybe in the early days of the capacity market thinking over here in GB, that long-term store contracts or long-term ancillary service contracts were considered as an alternative or as an option that we didn't ultimately pursue. I think now the thinking is, well, actually, you know, there's so much uncertainty about what our ancillary service needs are, that it's better to try and procure those things closer to real time. And that's obviously what we've seen across all the ancillary service markets, is this kind of push to day ahead procurement where possible, rather than months ahead or years ahead.
And you mentioned Black Start there. I'm not quite going to cover Black Start because I wouldn't really term it system security in the same sense as the other ones. I guess it is system security in that it, you know, restarts it or keeps a skeleton of it going. But it feels like it's a, you know, all this other stuff is before and Black Start is afterwards.
Yeah.
So we're going to put that to the side.
Yeah. But so in terms of a revenue, I meant it more in terms of a revenue mechanism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sort of paying somebody to be there.
Generally, Black Start stuff would act like strategic reserve.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of old mothballed retirement home for power stations.
We should subtitle this episode, The Retirement Home for All Power Stations. So the final part of security of supply is kind of the network operation investment, because once we've got the kit there to provide us the energy and we've got the kit that uses the energy, we need to transport it from where it's made to where it's used. So that means we need to have reliable and secure electricity and gas networks. So we need to have enough pipes that are the right pressure and security, enough wires that can carry the electricity from where it's being generated to where it's being consumed. And they need to be sufficiently reliable, sufficiently efficient, and we need to have enough of them in the right place at the right time. So generally, networks being quite different in operation to kind of generation or supply and demand or retail, they are monopolies, because it doesn't make sense to compete for having the same wire come into your house. It's really only need one wire to come into my house.
They're natural monopolies.
Yeah, natural monopolies, exactly, is the term that's used. Because it doesn't make sense to have two companies building the same wire over, you know, racing each other to the same destination.
Think of all the pylons. Gosh.
Yeah, exactly. So what the way this works then is, generally you will have that natural monopoly has a bunch of very smart people, engineers, who will sit and look at their network and go, okay, we have generation connecting here, demand connecting here. We either have too much generation coming or too much demand. We need to plan the system to move that energy from one place to the other. We either need to retire assets over here and build new ones over there. And they will go and talk to the regulator. So this is natural monopoly. Here's the idea of price controls. They'll talk to their regulator, come up with a design and say, okay, we need this many, you know, kilometers of wire, kilometer of pipe, has to work like this. So we need these transformers here. these shunt reactors here, etc., etc. It's going to cost us, we think, this much money. The regulators should have their own engineers who'll look back and go, actually, you probably don't do or don't need that, and we think it should cost this much money. And they argue with each other politely and come up with a price settlement. And then everyone pays them the money, they build the kit, we then have a system that should be able to deliver given those plans. That's governed by something in electricity called the SQSS, the System Quality Security of Supply Standard, which is the engineering document that sets out things like voltage shall not deviate between this much and that much, frequency shall not deviate between this much and that much. You should plan the system to take into account these type of events. So, you know, you need to have double lines on this kind of part of the transmission system so that if one falls over, there's a spare one. You need to have this many bays in the transformer so that the power can flow in and out and you've got this much headroom on top. So I think typically, they're supposed to go to 1.8 of the transmission system. So you need 1.8 times the amount of capacity. So if you've got a demand of 100 megawatts, you need to have 180 megawatts of network capacity to flow it just in case something breaks. I think actually in reality, it might be in some areas it's closer to 4.
Wow. Why?
Just because you want to be doubly sure. You might be in an area that's prone to storms or that the fault levels. So, for example, if one part of the line breaks, another line might get overloaded. So you want to have kind of double backup just in case, because it's a, you know, very well-traversed, well-used piece of equipment. So that, you know, that's the kind of design price control process. That's how we pay for it. There's then the idea of if you sign an agreement with these network companies, say large factories, large generators have an agreement to connect to the system, they expect a level of service. There's then the idea of compensation if you don't get that. So in generation or large demand, they might be paid to be able to disconnect from the system. They can expect some compensation. As a consumer, I can't get that. There's kind of no direct agreement between me and my network company. What there is, however, is that there's a regulatory regime that ensures I get some compensation. So if the network is unreliable, it gets blown over in a storm, or it's overloaded and needs to shut down for a bit, if it goes over a certain amount of time, then I could be paid compensation for losing that supply. And that's one of the sticks that we'll beat the network company with to get them to make sure the system works. And the carrot is the price control to get them to build the kit in the first place.
Incentive mechanism, to use the correct term. But yeah, characteristics.
So we've got our energy-only market, which in one part of the world is supposed to deliver us the energy we need and maybe the capacity. We've got a capacity remuneration mechanism, which is about smoothing out that investment approach and trying to get away from boom and bust cycles. We have ancillary services or balancing services, which are about making the operation of the system secure and safe. And then finally, we've got our network operation and investment, which is about building the equipment and operating it in a way that means the energy can reliably, securely, and efficiently get from where it comes from to where we want to use it.
And they broadly kind of map over to the different kinds of aspects of reliability that we spoke about last week. So there's that kind of, yeah, the capacity markets are kind of overall capacity adequacy and ensuring there's margin and, you know, that element. Ancillary services, as you mentioned, is that more nuanced kind of complex nature of electricity.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the final bit is the pipes and wires effectively that transport.
Having
that
enough
energy.
Of them, having them being reliable,
yes.
Having them being efficient.
Getting them to where they need to be.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So I think that's how we provide security of supply in liberalized energy markets in at least Europe and some North American and Australian markets. I guess what I didn't mention is, you know, things like, you know, the utility model, where all this is basically done internally. So in a place where you have a national utility that is in control of all of these aspects of energy, they might do all of these functions internally. They might buy the energy, you know, if they're buying energy and gas and coal on the international energy markets, they'll have that element of energy. They'll be deciding internally on what capacity to build based on their own projections of demand and, you know, talking to the manufacturers about the cost of capital, whether or not they then choose to figure that as a reserve or do flat capacity payments internally. That's an accounting problem.
The utility model, you're talking about a deregulated market here, but you've only got one supplier.
I mean, how a national utility might think about this.
So that'd be state-owned?
Yeah. There are private monopolies, I suppose. So there's really no difference between a private and a public monopoly. It's just who owns it at the end of the day. They'll operate in basically the same way. But all of this will be internal and accounted for. Someone will be doing the sums.
Yeah. But I guess notionally you could have somewhere in between the two, right? Where you have competition on the wholesale side. So generators are competing with each other. But then maybe you have a single supplier on the retail side who's procuring the right level of reliability, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So you could have a national utility that buys energy from private businesses. Yeah. So I guess, thanks for listening. The next bit, we're going to look at security supply in the net zero transition, which will be things like, what's a Dunkelflaute?
Why might security supply need to be different as part of the energy transition or net zero? What's different
about
the world?
Partly because of technologies. So different technologies have different characteristics. Partly because of variability in where the energy comes from and its source. So wind-driven, solar-driven. Partly because of where it is in the world. So it's windiest in the places furthest away from where most people live. So there's a bigger role for networks than there was before. You've got climate-related risks, such as it being very hot in the future, which might make thermal power stations less efficient. Floods, rising sea levels, all that sort of stuff. And then just the huge amount of cash that's going to be required from someone to pay for it. And you've got all that to look forward to. And then we'll probably also do maybe an episode on some case studies. So looking at some examples of what happened when security of supply wasn't there, such as the California electricity crisis, the Texas power outage, the 9th of August event in GB, the Australia blackout in 2016, South Africa for a long time, China 2020, all those sorts of stuff. We might look at them.
Nice. Thank you very much for listening to the Substation podcast.
Thank you. Follow us at Substation Pod on Twitter. Email us at thesubstationpodcast@gmail.com. Talk to us on LinkedIn. And see us at all the best electricity market industry events when we're allowed back in person.
Nice. See ya. Bye.
Bye.